This week in Retronauts, you must defeat Shen Long if you want to listen to this podcast. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and this episode is, let's look at the schedule and see what it says. This episode is a continuation of a topic we began back in episode 361. That was the Street Fighter 1 and Street Fighter 2010 episode, the games that people don't care about. But this episode, episode 367, according to the current schedule, is an episode, a topic that everyone cares about. And it's such a big topic that this may not be the only episode we do on this topic, because how do you contain that much? It is multitudes. It contains multitudes, multitudes of world warriors. Yes, that's right. We're talking about Street Fighter II. And there is a lot to say about Street Fighter II. So much to say that we're flying by the seat of our pants on this one. We did not take notes. We just, like, all of us here have lived this game. Like, we've spent so much time with it. We know so much about it. It is so deeply ingrained in the culture and texture of video games that, you know, I just want to see where we go, you know, kind of without a map, without a compass, just like talk about some street fighting. So who is here with me to take this global journey? Let's start on the east. By east, I mean where I am now, and then work our way west across the Pacific. So who is here in the same time zone as me?
I'm Kurt Kalata.
And Kurt was, of course, the one recurring guest. He is the Ken to my Ryu in this episode. He was in the Street Fighter 1 podcast, or maybe I'm the Ken. I don't know. Are you better at ground or aerial, Kurt?
I was all into Ken, but just because he set people on fire in the later games.
Okay, so I'll be the Ryu, the kind of boring one who's just always there. That's my role with Retronauts, to be the kind of the standby, the mainstay, the kind of boring guy. But I've got good red shoes, so it's all okay. Actually, I took them off for this episode. Anyway, heading west from here, who's that out there in California?
Hey, it's Kat Bailey, and if you're Ken and Ryu, I guess that makes me the token lady, so that would be Chun-Li, even though I never played her in the original game.
That's okay, because Chun-Li was my gal. She was nice. My favorite, so I'll have plenty to say about her. And then finally, off in Japan!
Hello, it's Diamond Fight, and get loose, you can't compare with my powers.
Excellent. So I'm sure you're wondering why I've called you all here together, and it's because I want you to talk about Street Fighter 2 with me. Now, I know all of you are huge fans of this game. You have a lot of history with this game, just like I do. I'm not any good at fighting games anymore, but there was a brief period of time, about 30 years ago, where young Jeremy was really, really, really into Street Fighter 2 in the arcade and then in the home version. So I have a lot of memories wrapped up with this game, and I followed it, you know, throughout the various permutations. I'm sorry, Mr. Ono, I did not play Ultra Street Fighter 2, but, you know, it's still a viable product in that sense. The most recent iteration, the most recent version of Street Fighter 2 came out in 2017 with the launch of Nintendo Switch. That's pretty remarkable. But the game actually made its debut almost exactly 30 years ago, the week of this recording, in February of 1991. And here we are in 2021, and it's still, like, the impact of Street Fighter II is still out there. So let me put it to you, the question to you, where did you each discover Street Fighter II? Diamond, let's start with you and work our way back toward the east coast of the U.S.
Well, firstly, I can say that I definitely remember Street Fighter 1. I did not play it much, but I remember seeing it a lot at the sort of go-to arcades that I would visit.
Wow, and so that actually puts you one up over most of the people who were on the Street Fighter 1 podcast. I'm sorry we didn't invite you.
No, it's fine. If I played it, I barely played it, because it didn't seem like my thing. I definitely saw the version that had, like, the big punch-sensitive buttons that, like, I'm not a strong person, but I just, like, this is not for me. So when Street Fighter 2 came out, I was sort of curious, like, well, they made another one, because that just wasn't, you know, if it had been Yi R Kung Fu 2, I'd be like, oh, snap, Yi R Kung Fu 2, you know, but instead it was like Street Fighter 2. Okay. But, you know, I think right from the start, the 2 is so many magnitudes improved over the first one, just from initial appearance alone and sounds, you know, just watching the game sit there in whatever format it's in. It just, the music is blasting. You get two giant characters. One of them punches the other one in the face. Like, okay, this is your game. Here we go. The first place I saw it, there are so many options. At this point in time, I was surrounded by, you know, I had an embarrassment of choices. It was probably one of the nearby locations near my high school, because arcade games were so popular at that point that there were businesses that were not even arcades. They would shove them in a corner and just have them there. So like the same places that would have had, say, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle beat 'em ups, or a Double Dragon, or Final Fight. Eventually, Street Fighter 2 would just appear there, and that was it. Then all the kids were just going there, you know, on lunch breaks or after school, and we were just all there, and we couldn't get away from it. And then it just became a thing. Like, you know, you'd hear it when it appears. Someone you meet would tell you, "Oh, they've got it down there now. They've got it over at the pizza place, you know, over there now." And it started spreading around, and then it was just everywhere. And every business that could have one would have one somewhere. And then eventually, of course, would be the upgrades or the pirate versions. And yeah, but for a time there, it was just everywhere. The vanilla version was just everywhere, and it was inescapable.
Mm-hmm. Kat, how about you?
I don't remember the first time that I saw it. I do know that I agree with Diamond, though, that it was ubiquitous, because I remember going to a place called Skateville, and Skateville was a roller skating rink, and there was a bunch of arcades there, and Street Fighter, I remember Street Fighter 2 catching my eye, because they had that really good eye catch where the two guys are kind of doing the bobbing and the waving, and then one does the punch, and they fall away, and then it goes up to Street Fighter 2, and then you get that amazing art. That amazing art always just immediately grabs your attention. You had to play that game. And then I became really, really obsessed with Street Fighter 2 for quite a while. I remember I had the tabletop role-playing game. Whoa. I was learning about all of the different heroes. I usually played Dalsim because I couldn't do any of the special moves because I was like 8. And so I would do the little slide kick all over the place all the time. And it was actually one of the few instances where I was able to bond with my parents, because there was a Street Fighter II machine, the local McDonald's, because they were putting arcade machines in McDonald's at that time. And I would basically beg my parents to take me to McDonald's so that kind of marketing would work. And my dad would give me a $20 bill, and we would play Street Fighter II together. And he was quite mean, because he would play E Honda and trap me in the corner and do the 100 hand slap. And it was very cheap, but it taught me a hard lesson, I guess.
That reminds me of, I guess we're going to go into anecdotes already. We'll get to you in a second, Kurt, but it just reminds me of one time I was at a movie theater, and this was, you know, back before Street Fighter II had a whole bunch of iterations, and I was just playing, you know, on my own quarter, and this little kid came up with his mom and wanted to play. I was like, well, I didn't say anything, but I was like, you know, I'm in the middle of a game. But she was like, okay, you can play. And so she let him play. And I was like, what do I do? Like, I was actually making some progress with the game. I'd beaten like 4 or 5 opponents, so I wanted to see how far I could go on my quarter. But at the same time, I didn't want to be an asshole and just like demolish this child. They were probably, you know, like 8 or 9. So I was playing Chun-Li, so because I always played Chun-Li, and basically just played keep away for 2 rounds, and the kid couldn't land any damage, and I like did one little tap and punched him so that I ended up winning. But I was like, I'm going to give you the most possible time you can have on this quarter, but I am not giving up my progress here, young man. So anyway, that's me kind of being a jerk, but not totally being a jerk.
Jeremy Parrish, no remorse.
I mean, if I had no remorse, I would have just slaughtered the child and been like, please go away. I tried to be nice and at least, you know, like let him feel like he was accomplishing something. But still, you know, that was the best I had done on one quarter before. So I couldn't give that up. Anyway.
Did you beat Bison?
No, I don't think I made it past Balrog. I was mostly used to the Super NES.
Well, you got to the bosses. That's really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd been playing it at home quite a bit. By that point, so I was like, oh, I can try the arcade again now that I've, you know, cut my teeth on the Super NES version. But the bosses in the arcade are really, really hard, like unbelievably difficult. So they beat me down pretty quickly. I was like, Balrog. With Chun-Li, I'm going to just wipe the floor with him. But no, I didn't. She lost all her teeth. It was terrible. Anyway, Kurt.
So I was in fifth grade at the time, and we had after school bowling. And I remember the arcade machines. One day we went there, and there was just a huge crowd around it. And that was my first exposure to Street Fighter II. Not so much playing it, just because I was 10 years old at the time, and all the kids who were playing it were teenagers that were so much better than any of us would be. But in between, you know, frames of bowling, we would go up and watch people. And, you know, maybe at the end of the day, we would have enough time to go in and get a round in. But it was really intimidating, not just because the kids were older, but just because of the controls. Because you had like 6 buttons just for attacking. There was no button for jumping or blocking or anything like that. So it was very different from any other game that I'd seen at the time. But, you know, you saw the other kids playing and they were like, shooting all these fireballs. And like Blanka was, I think at the time, my favorite character, just because he was not only a monster, but you could jam the buttons and electrocute people and just the easiest thing to do. But I didn't get to play it too much outside of that because my parents were kind of freaked out about arcades and were a little bit limited to letting me visit them. So a lot of my exposure for a while was just reading about them in video game magazines like Nintendo Power and Electronic Gaming Monthly, who were really into it. So I would follow it. I didn't get a Super Nintendo, so I was just begging and for when the Genesis port would eventually come out. Or I remember Electronic Gaming Monthly even had a little box out about one of the bootleg NES versions, like maybe Capcom will do an 8-bit version. We'll see. And of course they didn't. But eventually I got to play it a lot more when the Genesis version came out much later.
Yeah, when you talk about being the scary teenagers who were playing Street Fighter 2, that was so me because, like I already mentioned, I was like 8 or 9 when this game got really, really big in the arcades. And I was tiny. You know, I was this tiny girl. I'm in an arcade. And I had to like muster up the courage to walk up to one of those machines to play. And I could barely see over the controls to be able to get to the screen. But I do remember actually beating one of them in a round and feeling very good about myself. And then round two, they completely destroyed me. But
oh, see, that's what I should have done with that kid. I should have let him mop the floor with me in one round. And then... See, I was one of the scary teens. My long hair and everything. Yeah, the Street Fighter 2 is one of the few arcade games I can actually tell you when and where I was when I first saw it. Because I was in junior high school by that point, and we had math and science competitions, like interstate math science competitions that I would go to with my school group because we were nerds, and those were usually in San Antonio, Texas. And so I was there with some of my school friends. We were just hanging out on the Riverwalk before the competitions started, and there was an arcade, and we went into the arcade, just were kind of chilling around, you know, hanging around, chilling out. And there was Street Fighter 2. And I didn't think much of it at first because by that point I had seen Street Fighter 2010 for rental for NES and was like, wow, that game looks like a dog. I don't want anything to do with that. So when I saw Street Fighter 2, I thought, oh, it's probably related to that. But then we actually got up close to it and I saw it, and I saw Dalsium's stage with the elephants, and there's just this amazing depth effect, like this real sense of a three-dimensional diorama space where the elephants, you know, move relatively with parallax scrolling relative to one another as you move back and forth across the floor. And I was just drawn in by how detailed the graphics were, how huge the characters looked. I remember, you know, Dalsim setting his opponent on fire as we were watching someone play, and I was just like, wow, I cannot believe a game looks this good. I owned a Super NES by that point. No, actually, I guess I wouldn't have. But I, you know, the Super NES was on the horizon. But it was definitely like the month after the game came out in the US. It was March because that's when that event was. So it was pretty early on. And from that point, it was just a fixture. So the following year, you know, that summer, 1992, I got my first summer job and my first check that I got, I spent on a Super NES. And then basically, you know, like a month later, Street Fighter II came out, and I would basically go to Toys R Us every day after work, hoping that that would finally come in. And I would always just miss it by like an hour. They'd be like, oh yeah, we got like 12 copies in, and they sold out immediately. And it was crazy expensive. It was like an $80 game, but I was like, I have a job. I can afford this. I'm going to buy this game. So when it finally came out, I did. I bought it. And then all my friends would come over to my house. Even when I wasn't there, I had friends just like come over to play Street Fighter. And I was out like at work or something. My parents were like, oh, yeah, come in. I don't know when he'll be back, but you can hang out until he gets here. So like they would there was one time they came to my house, hung out of my room playing Street Fighter 2 for like 2 hours and then took off. And I came back and my parents were like, oh, yeah, your friends are here playing Street Fighter. I had no idea. What the hell? Anyway, so that's the kind of video game sensation, the phenomenon that game was, that people would just do weird ass stuff like that. It was completely bonkers.
It touched a chord. And I think that when you talk about how beautiful that game was, I think that Street Fighter II is one of the most beautiful games ever made. Because if you compare it to its contemporaries, there are plenty of beautiful 16-bit games, but there's just something about Street Fighter II that stands out. Every single stage is so lavishly illustrated with like really interesting background details. Every single character has a distinct personality in their animations and that the way they move and everything. And even today, when I'm playing it, I still think, man, this game is really a looker.
I'm still really fascinated by the floor scrolling effect because it's not static. This has like a sort of pseudo 3D look to it. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's probably just like some sort of like line scrolling effect, but it's very impressive. And they did a pretty good job of simulating it on NES. It's not the same, but you know, as home ports go, that was a pretty impressive one. And it definitely, you know, I would for a while I was taking my Super NES with me whenever I would go hang out with friends, and that cartridge, and that's all anyone wanted to do was just play Street Fighter 2. And there was a brief window of time where because I was the only one who had a Super NES and Street Fighter 2, I was actually the best at the game, and no one wanted to play me. Like they were always like, "Oh, we have to play Jeremy. He's gonna stomp us." So I'd use like Zangief or something to handicap myself because he's like the exact opposite of Chun-Li. Like my approach to the game was always just like move around a lot, jump, stay away, like keep out of reach, and you know,
do
just,
that damn heel kick.
Yep, the heel kick, you know, the aerial jump ins. So, you know, if someone was good with Ken or Sagat, then I was pretty much just hopeless, like just complete toast. But those were my real weaknesses, and everyone else I was really good against. And it's weird to look back and think at one time in my life I was really good at a fighting game, at least compared to my peer group. Because that is sure not the case now.
Yeah, it kind of makes me a little sad in a way, because it was an age of an instance where you could play a competitive game and think, I'm very good at this. I am beating the crap out of my friends. And the rise of the internet and the rise of competitive communities is fun in some ways, but it also is really discouraging. And I think that is maybe a part of why fighting games feel so unapproachable now, because once upon a time, you would stroll up to that arcade machine and think, I could take some of these people, and now it just feels like this insurmountable mountain.
Yeah, I remember playing Street Fighter IV when it first came out in arcades in Japan, and I was like, man, you know, I pretty much have missed Street Fighter since, like, Alpha 3, so this will be fun. It's been almost a decade. I kind of miss this series. I want to check it out, and just, oh, it was just sad. I mean, I played as Chun-Li, but I did not play as Chun-Li well. I was just utterly demolished, and it was very demoralizing. Things changed, and I did not. I got old, and games got fast. And that was a big part of how Street Fighter II evolved, was through player feedback, through, you know, kind of seeing how people played, what people wanted. I don't know if you've read the oral history of Street Fighter II that Polygon published like 4 years ago, but they really go into a lot of detail on that. Matt Leone did the interviews for that again. And they really went into a lot of detail about how there was a kind of basic culture clash between the US and Japanese arm. And the US arm of Capcom had a lot of influence and a lot of say over how the game evolved and how, you know, like kind of what was the right choice to make, which is something that they don't really have anymore. But at the time, because the US was such a big market and was so important, you know, so profitable for Capcom, the you know, there was a lot of feedback from the US, and a lot of the way the game evolved shaped around American tastes for a long time. And now I think it's gone more to sort of a Japanese kind of perspective, and you know, they listen more to their home market these days. But that wasn't always the case, and it's a really interesting sort of I mean, it's fitting that it's an international game, because the whole theme is you are the world warrior. You are traveling around the world to Thailand and Japan and so forth, and USA, fighting all these guys, you know, all these stereotypes. It's even better than Punch-Out.
Well, I think there's a connected tissue there, because if you look at Final Fight, which is sort of the, you know, the phantom game in between Street Fighter 1 and Street Fighter 2 is Final Fight. And you look at how that game was made and how they specifically created it with this idea of appealing to Americans. They wanted to make this game that players would just, in America, would just pump lots of coins in, because that's what they saw in their research, that Americans would go to the arcade. They were buying a lot. A lot of the games were tokens, not actual money. So kids would just put in lots of coins and they would just play the game for a long time. It didn't matter how many coins it spent. So they had that philosophy in mind, and they watched a lot of American movies. And so that was sort of the genesis of Final Fight, and Final Fight did very, very well. So here's Street Fighter II, and if you look at the early documents and sort of the early sketches of each character, both Guile and Honda, the notes under them are sort of like, oh, this is really easy for an American to understand. You know, Guile is just this big, muscular, blonde guy, and the commands are very simple, and E. Honda's like, oh, he's a sumo wrestler. Well, everyone knows sumo wrestlers. You know, you don't have to know much about Japan to know what a sumo wrestler is. So it's like, clearly from the start, they had a global market. They were thinking about the American market. So I guess once they started putting machines out there or talking to their American branch, I think they were really interested in, okay, well, what do you think? What do you see? You know, how can we make this happen? And it definitely paid off.
I like this when I was really young, because of, like, Mega Man was a game that really sparked my imagination, because there was just so many different characters that you could make up. So I had, you know, my own collection of little Mega Man guys. But Street Fighter 2 was kind of the same way, because there were only, I mean, there are 12 characters in the original game, but like, how many countries were actually represented? Like seven
there's,
or eight?
Yeah, there's
not that many.
Two Japans, three USAs, two Thailands. So yeah, it kind of whittles it down. There's one China, one Brazil, one Russia, USSR, sorry.
But then you would sort of think, like, you know, what would a character from, you know, Mexico or Canada look like? And it just, you know, made you really excited for the next entry, which sort of overflowed to the games that kind of ripped it off, like World Heroes.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of the characters, I think that's someplace where we see where this game really kind of diverges from the original Street Fighter. With the original Street Fighter, they really tried, you know, because the designer, I just totally blinked on his name, Nishitani, was that it?
Yes.
Yeah, so he was really into martial arts. And so they really tried to bring a lot of actual martial arts flavor, like every Street Fighter in Street Fighter 1 represented a different kind of fighting style, except there were a couple of Muay Thai, a couple of, you know, karate, but even so, there was still a great diversity of kind of real world analogs of, you know, existing martial arts. Whereas Street Fighter II, they really, you know, with the character designs, a big part of why they're so eclectic and so interesting is that everyone who worked on the game, you know, there were lots of people designing characters. It was a pretty big staff compared to the first game. And the director was kind of like, you just do what you think is right. Like, design your character and have fun with it. So you get characters who are way more out there, like Blanca and Dalsim. Like, you know, you can see how Dalsim is sort of a stereotype of India. He does yoga and he eats curry and that turns into flame. But then, you know, he's got elephants and, you know, does mystical teleporting and stuff. Like, it gets really out there. But then Blanca, like, how the hell is that even Brazil? Like, what about Blanca says, ah, yes, this green young man is definitely the heart of Brazil. That is what I think of when I think of Rio de Janeiro.
I thought I was very confused by this character back in the day. So I was like, so he's a monster? How did he become a monster? Because he lived in the jungle and he learned how to do the electrical attacks from electric eels. His biography was very strange to me.
He's an odd character, but you know, the lead designer of the game, Akira Nishimura, has said that he basically, like, he wouldn't design a game like this nowadays because things are just bigger and more important and more refined, you know, kind of more buckled down. But in this game, it was just like, everyone bring your best ideas in here. And the designers really kind of took ownership of their individual characters, and each of them tried to make their characters really, really cool. And just like there was this kind of push and pull where everyone was like, well, I want my character to be the best. And that's why Dalsim's arms stretch so far. Like, originally, apparently, like, his arms stretched about half as far. And they were like, whoa, that's kind of overpowered. But then they just kept pushing and pushing. And now his arms stretch like halfway across the screen. But, you know, at the same time, there's a drawback to that, because when you really go for it and you do one of those stretchy attacks across the screen, he's very vulnerable. Like, if he doesn't connect with that, then he's basically exposing himself as a huge target. So someone like Chun-Li can just hop over his arms and bonk him on the head. So, you know, it worked out to be not necessarily the best balanced game, but I think because there was actually kind of like a rivalry within the staff, and that actually translates into the game where each character, there's almost kind of like that Mega Man rock, paper, scissors thing where a character may be really, really good in one match and then really, really worthless in another. Like, Ken is going to be awesome against Chun-Li or against Vega, you know, because he's so anti-aerial, but he's not going to be as strong against someone who has a more grounded style and can really counter his jumping attacks. So, you know, it works out to be this really, really interesting, really fun game. And I think a lot of it was just, I wouldn't say by mistake or by happenstance, but it was just kind of instinctive. I think, you know, the designers just really kind of put their all into it. And because they were so talented and kind of all working together in this space and such a great environment and really striving to do their best, what you ended up with was this huge passion project. And it wasn't like one of those passion projects like Mega Man 2, where they were, you know, sneaking in and doing it at night when they were supposed to be working on some other game. Like, this was their job. And I've read different accounts of this, anywhere from like 10 months to 2 years. It was like 40 people just plugging away at this arcade game, you know, spending millions of dollars in investment and salaries and everything to make this one game. But it absolutely paid off because it was one of the absolute hugest games of all time. I think it was the best selling game, like arcade game, since Pac-Man when it shipped in its original format. So, you know, sometimes you just got to let great people do great things and it pays for itself. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, what you're describing, Jeremy, reminds me a little bit of how they created the original Pokemon, how it was a very collaborative process and everybody had kind of their own ideas when they were coming together. Like, a few of the artists, there were a couple artists that did the bulk of the actual designs, but I think that when you have that kind of passion project kind of aspect to it. I mean, when you look at Street Fighter 2, I mean, is there a single dud within the original 8 World Warriors? All of them are kind of iconic in their own way, right?
They're very memorable. I'm not a fan of Zangief, but I just don't like slow,
Zangief?
Beefy
Oh, come
fighters.
On. Zangief, everybody loves Zangief.
I mean, he's great as a character. I just don't think he's interesting to play as.
But there are the people who just absolutely own the whole grappler thing.
That's true.
They really enjoyed being like, I want to learn how to play this really unconventional character and get good at him because he's hard.
It's definitely, he's a character that demands a lot of, You have to put your time in because you have so many characters who have, you know, they can literally throw fireballs. You've got Dhalsim who can stretch his limbs. It takes work to be good at Zangief because you have to get close. But once you get close, if you're good at Zangief, then yes, you can do a lot of damage in a very short amount of time. So I think it is a really interesting, you know, I don't think there was a master balance plan, but it is funny how all the characters sort of, they all have their strengths and everyone has their fans, I think. I was never big into playing Zangief at the time, but I can see the appeal, and I could see my friends who were good at Zangief. It's like, oh yeah, that's really hard. I can't do that, especially the unconventional 360 motion on the joystick. Like that's, you have to practice that. You have to learn how to do that without jumping, because mm-hmm. of course up is jump. So it takes a lot of practice to even do that move without leaving the ground at first. But if I just real quick, just to clear it up, because I know there's a bunch of people who have very similar names on this. So Takashi Nishiyama is the creator of the original Street Fighter.
Okay.
Who was gone by the time the sequel started. Akira Nishitani was part of the first team and he stuck around and he's credited as designer on 2. And he would later become, the creator of Arika. So he's still involved in fighting games, but he's not with Capcom anymore. And the artist who's kind of behind the whole look of this whole thing was Akira Yasuda, or Akiman, and he was on Street Fighter 1, he was in Final Fight, he was definitely all about Street Fighter 2. So those three names are really big, and they're all kind of similar, and I mix them a lot, so I just want to make sure we got those
three.
Yeah,
and I said Nishimura earlier, but that's
yes.
Kinuyo Nishimura, I think, right? The illustrator?
Yes.
So I know she's done some Street Fighter art, so... Yeah, a lot of people. What does Nishi mean? It's like West, right?
Yeah, literally West.
Okay, so this franchise went West, young man. So yes, I apologize for mixing up the names. There are some very, very similarly constructed names, however. But yes, Nishitani left, or no, Nishiyama left Capcom after Street Fighter 1. We talked about that a lot in the previous podcast, but basically SNK made him an offer he couldn't refuse, which was like, hey, we'll let you work and you don't have to work under Okamoto, who doesn't like you. And so that worked out for him. And he made some of Diamond's favorite games.
Oh, yes.
Over at SNK. And then, yeah, Nishitani stepped in and kind of led the design on this. And then Yoshiki Okamoto was the producer on this, but he was, at this point, was like the head of the games division, along with Tokuro Fujiwara. They were both like the guys from the early days of Capcom who had risen up the ranks and were kind of looking down beatifically or not so beatifically at everyone and kind of overseeing things. And, you know, Okamoto is credited with having a great instinct for recognizing hit potential in a game. And so I think he really put his weight behind this one, his clout, and, you know, kind of gave the dev team the latitude to do what they needed to do to make their game. And he was right. Like these, the game turned out great. And it's interesting because it's, you know, Street Fighter 2, which obviously is a sequel to Street Fighter, but it doesn't bring over many of the characters from Street Fighter 1, only three of the characters, right, return. Even M. Bison is not Mike, the boxer from the first game. It's very confusing, but no, canonically, he is a different character. You have Ken, you have Ryu, and you have Sagat. And then everyone else is brand new, and each of them brings a little something different to the game. Yeah, I mean, honestly, we could just talk about the characters now because they are such an iconic part of the Street Fighter franchise. And I think these original eight have shown up in just about every iteration of the series. I mean, you know, with Street Fighter V, like everyone's in that. Who isn't in Street Fighter V? I think I'm in Street Fighter V and I'm not even a Street Fighter. But the original eight plus the four bosses, you know, they're just iconic. I mean, Zangief showed up in Wreck-It Ralph. Like, Ryu, where hasn't Ryu shown up in? You know, like, you can play 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon or 1 Degree of Ryu. He's just in like every series, especially now that he's in Smash Brothers. Like that connects him to the entire Nintendoverse, basically. He's just ubiquitous. He's such an iconic character. And he's so plain looking. He's just a dude in a white gi with a red headband and red gloves. But there's just something about him, his stance and his skills. He's very distinctive. He's an icon. And, you know, sometimes being an icon means you're a little bit boring because you're just so common, so pervasive. And that's definitely the case for him. Like, everyone knows Ryu.
I think it's interesting that we talk about, I don't know if it's a rivalry or disagreement, cultural disagreements between the Japanese side and the American side of Capcom at this time, but that Ryu and Ken are the Japanese character and the American character, eternal rivals within the game as well.
And fittingly, the American character is actually, even though Ken is supposed to be evenly matched with Ryu, there's a bug in the original World Warrior where Ken does not have some vulnerability frames. He has like invincibility after his special moves that Ryu does not have. So he actually is a stronger, more durable character. So he has the upper hand in this, just as the American arm of Capcom had the upper hand, even though the game was made in Japan.
Fittingly, within the lore, they made Ryu the one who was the strongest, and Ken, or like maybe Ken had the most potential, but he was happy getting married and having a kid like a loser. He wasn't always on the road looking for the next fight like Ryu.
Yeah, but canonically, Ryu hasn't ever won a Street Fighter tournament since the original Street Fighter, right?
Maybe.
I think the whole, like, he's kind of like Ash and Pikachu.
He won in Street Fighter 2.
I mean, Ken's ending, he gets married, so that seems like the canon ending, wouldn't it be?
Well, let's see. According to this forum thread on Reddit, so who knows, Guile won Street Fighter 2, Zangief won Street Fighter 4, Alex won Street Fighter 3. So there you go.
Well,
Ryu is, you know, he's devoted his life to the cause, but then he gets beaten down by Sakura.
So one of the things that always stood out to me back in the, you know, when I was getting to know Street Fighter 2 and wanting to learn the lore and everything, was it talks about how Ryu gave Sagat that giant ugly scar on his chest from the Dragon Punch. And I was like, wow. And this was in the original Street Fighter. And I didn't know what the heck the original Street Fighter was because I had never seen it in an arcade or anything. And I thought, Street Fighter 2 is amazing. Street Fighter 1 must also be just incredible. But I did not know anything about it. Finally, when it came out on PC, I think there was bundled together. And I saw a screenshot of the original Street Fighter at last. And I thought, that doesn't look very good. So, but I still haven't played it to this day, honestly, actually. It was just that game that was kind of over there, and I shrouded in mystery until Street Fighter Alpha came out and started cribbing characters from Street Fighter 1.
Your instincts serve you well.
At the time, there was kind of that trend where there was arcade games that had sequels in them, but like nobody really knew where the first games were. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you had Afterburner 2. And Galaxy Force 2, and this wasn't an arcade game, but there's Thunder Force 2. I remember there's an Amiga game called Apidia, where they called itself Apidia 2 just to, like, play into that. Like, what was the first game? It's just this Japanese mystery.
Well, I think my point was, is the reason I bring this up is that I really love how they embedded storytelling into the character designs, even though the actual storytelling itself is fairly minimal.
Mm-hmm. Didn't it make it at that point like Street Fighter felt like a legend that you just didn't know anything about?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean the endings for each character, you know, they have this like story to them, and they're just presented in this kind of minimalistic way that it feels like you're expected to know what the story is there, like you're supposed to know what these characters are all about, and you don't because there's no description or anything. It's just, you know, like little vignettes or something, but it just feels like it's part of a larger world. And I think that's why Street Fighter 2 was so easily expanded outward into a multimedia property, because, you know, there are these very evocative characters. There are these rivalries. There's this history there. And, you know, each character, even though they are shown in extremely like brief flashes of like three sentences. They each have their own motivations and their own desires. And so that does, you know, provide hooks, a lot of storytelling hooks for people who want to jump onto that and explore it in different ways. And we can probably do an entire episode on Street Fighter II media, honestly. But you know, it was right there in the games. Like, there were these hints of something bigger, and it was very enticing, you know, to get a glimpse into those bigger worlds.
They put a lot of work into the single player stuff, because again, I spent most of the time with the console ports that I was playing by myself. But there's endings for all the 12 characters, but at the different difficulty levels, they would, like, there's changes and stuff that they would do to give you challenges to play a little bit more. Like, even if it was just Chun-Li saying something at the end. But I mean, this is before games really had story modes. But I really appreciated that effort they put into it.
Yeah. If you could beat the game at the level 7 difficulty on Super NES, you got like a special ending. And one of the most frustrating game experiences of my life was trying to beat M. Bison with any character on level 7 difficulty. I got it so, you know, on basic difficulty, I could actually finish the game with everyone. But you crank up the difficulty to max, and even with, you know, the character I was best at, it's so cheap and so frustrating. I am not a rage type player, but I busted a controller and busted a desk, like not busted, but definitely damaged a desk just out of sheer frustration, trying to beat M. Bison. I did it once and said, okay, you know what? I did it. I'm never going to do this again. That was the worst.
Jeremy, did you actually try to get Shenlong? Did you buy into that code in EGM?
You know, I don't think I did, because I'd already been burned by the play as Simon Belmont in TMNT2. And, you know, a friend and I bought that magazine, and we took it to his house, and we spent like half an hour trying to play as Simon Belmont in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2. And then we realized the name on the letter that wrote in about that, or the provided the code, was A P Earl Fool or something like that. We were like, ah, damn it. So after that, I did not trust anything in terms of secrets that I saw in EGM. I knew better. So no, they did not get me with Shenlong.
You know, I wasn't much of an EGM reader back in the day, but somehow I had that particular issue, and I remember that code very well with its very convincing screenshots. So I was like, oh, yeah, so you can totally get Shenlong. I thought that was a real thing. I didn't think I would ever try and get it because I wasn't good enough. But years later, when I was like, oh, no, that was like a very famous April Fool's joke, I was like, you got me, EGM, you got me.
I remember picking up one issue that promised the long legendary play as the boss codes for the original Super Nintendo game. But then, of course, you actually got to the code page, and there was like a gigantic asterisk by it. Like, you know, it does not completely work right, you know.
There was a code in the Super NES game where you could play against, they could do mirror matches, right?
Yeah. This is like a regular button combination, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, there were a few different combinations. It's all coming back to me, like punching in that button combo as the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Is that played? Like, that sound is drilled into my head. I can't remember what the code was, but yes, I do remember punching in the code while the Capcom logo appeared on screen so I could play mirror matches.
Just, there's so many little things that I'm thinking about over the last 5 minutes that we've spoken about. And the one that jumps in my head the most, the fact that, yeah, the Street Fighter 1 is basically it is a single story, you play as you, right? You can't pick the other characters. Like, that's the one player game, you play this character. And to have Street Fighter 2 open up, it's like, no, here are 8 characters, you can pick any of them. But the catch is, you have to fight all the other ones. And I thought it was really interesting, you know, when you got to play it as, you know, as a one player game, you slowly make your way around the world, and you have this little cute little map with animals on it. It's really a great map, and you make your way through it and you fight all these characters. If someone joins you and you beat them, that counts as a win. Like, if someone joins your game and plays you as Blanka and you beat Blanka, you don't have to fight Blanka anymore when you go back to one player. It remembers who you've beaten already. So if you're in a pinch, you can actually put in, if you have trouble fighting a character, you can always put another coin in and just beat a vacant player too, if you really want to get cheese your way to victory. But then you think, you know, the first time you experience this game, you're like, oh, great, I beat all the characters. And then the map just like, here are more people. You're like, wait, who? And those bosses appear, and those bosses are not on any menu. That you don't, unless you fight them, you don't see them. So the reveal of that was so incredible. The fact you meet the three bosses, and then you beat them, and then you meet one more boss. It's like, it's the way it's unfolded. Gosh, yeah, it really got to me. And the fact that also, yeah, the bosses, you know, as little as you know about the regular characters, the bosses you know even less about. The only thing you get about them is if they beat you, they say something to you, and that's all you have. So you see, you know, when you first meet M. Bison, like, what do you even make of that? He's like a general, but he can light his body on fire, and he can, like, fly across the screen. Like, who is this guy? What the hell is going on? It blew my mind. It blew my mind. And, it, you know, to actually beat him and fight him and to actually get past him took so many, you know, it takes a lot of effort the first time you encounter that. It's, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because it just occurred to me, this is probably something like people have known about for a long time and it's just obvious, but they basically took the Mega Man formula here where you've got 8 stages, you beat the 8 stages, and then you have the Dr. Wily stages. There's 4 segments that you have to complete, and those don't show up on the map until you complete all the 8 stages. They basically just took that structure, that formula, and transplanted it into a different genre altogether. That's brilliant. Like, they just took their strength, their core strength, and said, let's do it. I don't even know if they deliberately did that. It's just how it worked out. I don't know, but it's great.
It's funny if you think about it from a timeline perspective, though. They're like, the entire genesis and creation and ascension into celebrity of Mega Man is contained in between Street Fighter and Street Fighter 2.
Pretty much, yeah.
Because the first arcade game was 87, and this is 91, and Mega Man came out at the very, very end of 1987. So the whole time they were making and pitching ideas on what eventually turned into Street Fighter 2, they could see on home consoles the Mega Man, you know, explosion.
Did any of you have a favorite boss? Because I was very much into Vega with that braid and the hockey mask and the big old claw and the way that he could climb up the cage in the background and fly down on you. Yeah, he was very cool.
That was infuriating to me.
He was such a weird character, especially in the Champion Edition ones, because he would only use the climbing set in his stage. Mm-hmm. And there weren't any other characters that were like that. But yeah, his spinning attacks, you know, the charge ones are the ones we just leap up. Those are super fun.
He was my main in after Street Fighter 2, like in Championship and Turbo, because he was like Dalsum in that he could do the slide attack, but he also had a big old claw. So that's why I liked him too.
Well, he was also the only Street Fighter aside from Chun-Li who could jump off the edge of the screen even when there wasn't a wall there. Like, that's a unique power to the two of them, is to be able to do kind of like a double jump off the edge of the screen, no matter where you are. So that gives them both a very unique utility that I find very helpful. But yeah, I always liked Vega because I always saw him, and we're using the American names here, yes. I always saw Vega as kind of like the evil counterpart to Chun-Li, since I always played as Chun-Li. That was always like the rivalry. Like, Sagat was just really hard to beat as Chun-Li because he's so anti-air. Balrog was, you know, very, very simple. M. Bison never really appealed to me. There's just something about him that I find very unappealing. But Vega was interesting because he's so flamboyant. He has, like, you know, you can break the mask. You can, if you hit him right, you can break his mask. Like, that's a really interesting detail that no other character has. There's just something unique about him.
You can break the claw too.
You can break the claw. He has the wall behind him. He's just really, really distinctive and unique. And he does have a lot of the same utility and mobility as Chun-Li. So it was always a really interesting match. Like, You know, I'd go into Balrog knowing, like, I'm just going to devastate this guy. I'd go into Sagat knowing this is going to be rough. But against Vega, it was always like, this could go either way. This is exciting.
I remember Vega being a very popular character. I remember Guile being a very popular character. And it's bringing me a memory. Did any of you, when you went to the arcade, did any of you see a version of Street Fighter II that had, like, a projection screen so it was really, really big?
Not a Street Fighter II, no.
Interesting. Okay, so there was a Circus Pizza, which was our local arcade, and they had a projection screen and then a stand-up kind of arcade station that you could go up to. And so the Street Fighter II machine would end up being the centerpiece of the arcade, and that's where everybody would be gathering around. And it always seemed like Vega was one of the people on that particular screen for Championship Edition.
So the counterpart to the favorite boss, who did you main? I mean, I've talked a lot about how I played so much as Chun-Li. I probably should shut up about it, actually. But I'm curious about everyone else. Like, you know, Kat, you mentioned you played as Dhalsim early on before you really understood combos. But once you got a handle on the game, who did you stick with usually?
I either played as Blanca or Guile because I liked the charge attacks. Mm-hmm. I had a really hard time with the quarter circle forwards and the Shoryuken kind of inputs for a long time until I got the Super NES version in like 2000 when I finally mastered those inputs. So I was always playing as the characters who I could actually do the special moves for. But these days, I would say that I'm actually more of a Ken player. So when I'm playing Street Fighter II, I usually break out Ken.
Oh, you've gone Shoto. Can't believe it. Diamond, how about you?
Betrayal.
Well, very similar to Kat in that when I first encountered the game, and, you know, I guess another aspect we should probably mention, the fact that all these moves that all these characters have, at least in my experience, I never saw them written down or displayed anywhere. It's kind of thing, you know, you had to learn them from somebody. So when we all first experienced this game, we didn't know any of the moves at all. It would be a shock when you'd see the move. So Dhalsim sort of by default had this what seemed to be an advantage, like, oh, you just push the regular button and you get these really, really long attacks. So, yeah, my initial playthroughs were all Dhalsim because I could just use these, you know, long punches, long kicks, and I had an advantage over everyone else. Once we started learning about the actual techniques and how to do the things, I probably switched over to Ryu or Ken. Probably Ken more than you, just because Ken just seemed more exciting. And I don't remember if this is from the first game or the championship edition, but I know that when you do, for example, the hurricane kick, Ryu's hurricane kick like hits once and knocks you down, but Ken's hits you more than once. And I thought that was just cooler. But I don't remember if that's the first game or revision aspect. But yeah, I pretty much switched over to those two and stuck with them for a long time. Once Championship Edition came out, though, I absolutely switched to Bison because, as I said, I was fascinated by Bison. I couldn't get enough of, like, who is this guy? What's his deal? And, yeah, I also kind of found a way where I could kind of cheese the computer by doing the flaming Psycho Crusher over and over again and just throwing them out of it, even if they blocked it. So, yeah, although there was eventually one Pirate Edition that let you sort of do jumps in the, like, you could jump and do a move and jump again and do a move and jump again and do a move. So then I would actually be able to play as Zangief, because once you do that, you can basically jump yourself off the screen and kind of scroll yourself over the, like, through the screen more than once, and then you can't be hit. So once you're doing that, you can very easily line yourself up with the other character and then do a pile driver, and then you fall through the screen multiple times. This is hard to explain, but, like, actually doing it was hilarious to me. So I would just do that for hours.
It's interesting that you found Bison so compelling, because, like I said, I just, like, there was something about him I found really off-putting, and I really hated fighting him, and I never wanted to play him. I played him once or twice and was just like, ugh, I don't like this guy. I don't like the way he controls and his moves, and I don't like the way he looks. No. Stick with the Chinese martial artist for me. Thank you.
Well, that look is interesting to me because a few years later, actually many years later, is when I learned that Bison's whole look, almost exactly, is copied from the Rikkyo manga. Hmm. And that movie, that late 90s movie, which sort of became a meme because of the crushing head on The Daily Show. Like, when I actually saw that movie and I fell in love with that movie, when I found out that one of my favorite Street Fighter characters is totally stolen from the manga that related to that movie, I just thought that was a fun coincidence.
Huh. I did not know that.
Yeah. If you look, if you Google it, you'll see the drawing. It's like, it's almost exactly stolen from the manga.
So the boss in Gunstar Heroes is also taken from the manga and it's not just a Bison ripoff.
Probably. There are a lot. I mean, there are a lot of, I would say the popularity of Street Fighter 2 meant a lot of games took that icon. Like, you know, there's a general in Kaiser Knuckle who's basically, you know, looks like Bison. There's a World Heroes character who looks a lot like Bison. So Bison became more popular. But if you look at where Bison comes from, it is almost exactly copied from a panel in Nikkyo, the original manga.
Got it.
So I think it's the warden of the prison.
So people could rip off Bison and then say, oh no, prior art. Look, there's manga.
Yeah. Okay. There's a lot of, I mean, if you look down the line of characters, all those characters have sort of a shady connection to some established popular character or real life person. Mm-hmm.
All right, and Kurt, what about you, your favorite character?
Same story as everybody else. I started off with Blanca and Dhalsim just because they seemed to be the easiest to play as. But once I was comfortable and actually playing and doing special moves, I was all about Ken. Just because, you know, he's easy to use. Sure, Yukon is really powerful, and he had the coolest theme music.
He so does, doesn't he? Like, and the music across the board in Street Fighter 2 is really good, but when the Ken music starts going, you just get automatically pumped up.
Especially, you know, when you're really getting down to the wire and they play the up-tempo version, it's just such a good version of it.
And it kind of became the de facto Street Fighter 2 music, didn't it?
Did it? I always think of Guile as the de facto music.
Mm. But that's just because it's a meme.
Probably. But I mean, it's very memorable. It's got that big bombastic dun 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 dun. Like it just sounds different than everything else in the game. There's a lot less of the kind of polyrhythmic style that the other themes have, and it's just much more of like an orchestral, you know, kind of going for that Top Gun thing. The composer Yoko Shimomura, of course, now is probably best known for Kingdom Hearts, but you know, she worked for Squaresoft for a long time. In-house and then became a freelancer. She's done all kinds of stuff. She's extremely talented. But this was really, I think, really where she sort of made her name.
My favorite Shimomura connection was, you know, she did Ken's theme of Street Fighter 2. And then she also did the sound check to Live Alive, the Super Famicom RPG. And one of the characters is all, I think they're technically a wrestler, but it's basically thematically identical to Street Fighter 2. Mm-hmm. And there's a version that is like basically herself doing a different version of the Ken theme. Like that one YouTube arranger. Is either Silver Gunner or...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he changes his name around a lot because his channel gets shut down. And so comes up with a slightly different name.
Somewhere on
I know you're like Gunner Sleva, Gunner Silva. Yeah.
Yeah. Somewhere on his channel, they mashed up the two versions of those tracks and it's so good.
You know, one thing we didn't really talk about, Diamond mentions Final Fight very briefly, but the, you know, Street Fighter 2 was not a given. You know, Street Fighter 1, Capcom sank a lot of resources and a lot of energy into it, pinned a lot of hopes on it, and it didn't do that well. Even though it was a well-designed game for the most part, there were a lot of things about it that just didn't quite work. And, you know, we've talked about the big rubber pneumatic buttons that didn't work, but also the fact that executing special moves was very easy for the CPU and very difficult for players. And, you know, the game just underperformed. It didn't sell it to expectations. And even though there was the Street Fighter 2010 game that was released in 1990, that was totally unrelated and, you know, just kind of its own thing. And in the meantime, Capcom was like, well, maybe this isn't the right thing. Let's try to do the Double Dragon thing. We'll make this Final Fight game. And, you know, initially that was sold as Street Fighter 89. That was how it was originally solicited. But I think, according to who you listen to, either it wasn't enough like a Street Fighter game to call it Street Fighter, you know, it was too different, or there just wasn't any like brand recognition to Street Fighter, so why not just create a new project? But in any case, that was kind of like the midpoint. Like Final Fight sort of came in between and was very, very popular, very successful. Like it was everywhere. And for whatever reason, you know, that kind of gave them an opportunity to pause and sort of collect themselves and take another shot at Street Fighter II. And the game was, like I said, it wasn't a given, but they decided to go for it. And, you know, I think, like I said, Okamoto recognized, you know, what they're doing here is good and it's going to do well for us. So they got the green light and they just went for it.
You can see a lot of connections between Street Fighter 2 and Final Fight. Just aesthetically speaking, you've got those bright yellow life bars that empty into red, which is exactly what Final Fight had. You've got the car smashing scene, which is straight up taken from Final Fight. And even way back when you talked about the fact that Dalsim can light people on fire, if you get hit by a fire bomb or something, your entire body turns into this burning body sprite. So I don't know if it's the exactly same sprite, but it looks very similar. It's almost exactly the same sort of feeling.
It's kind of the Capcom house style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can tell a lot of stuff that just stuck. They liked it. Like, let's just do that again. Let's do that again. And I know somewhere in the intro, Mike Hagar even describes himself as a former Street Fighter. So, like, there's a lot of connection there. And, of course, they would go on to develop that even more in the Alpha series. And eventually all the characters would just start connecting over and fighting each other, which is fantastic because they're all really fun characters.
Yeah, I mean, by the time Alpha 3 came out, it was basically like Final Fight is the side story to Street Fighter. They're so intimately connected. And I think the Game Boy Advance version took it even further by introducing like Maki and some of the characters from Final Fight 2 and 3. So yeah, there's a very deep connection there. But we'll talk about Final Fight in a separate episode, and definitely we'll talk about Street Fighter the Alpha series in some later episodes. But yeah, it was just this kind of game out of nowhere, and it's interesting because again, reading recollections. When people talk about Street Fighter II, they talk about how basically it invented the concept of multiplayer gaming. Like that is honestly exactly how people phrase it. Like the idea of competitive multiplayer gaming. And that's so interesting because, you know, up until the early 80s, most games were competitive and multiplayer because there just wasn't enough power to create good AI. So if you look back at, you know, like the early Atari 2600 games, all the launch games, except like the math game, those were all multiplayer. There wasn't really a versus CPU mode. And a lot of these old arcade games like Grand Track 10 or whatever in the 70s, you know, that was strictly competitive. You could not race against the CPU because there was no CPU. It was, you know, like there literally was not a CPU. It was just transistors. And
I mean, there were sports games in the 80s that you could play against your friends.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But people still, like, not just the developers of Street Fighter, but fans of the series, and just, you know, in general, like when you read retrospectives, they're like, this invented competitive multiplayer gaming. And it's just really interesting how much that kind of early form of gaming has been kind of forgotten. And so everyone is just like, wow, there was no such thing as competitive gaming before this. That's crazy. It's very interesting to me.
It's just the contrast, I guess, because, you know, in the late 80s, the beat-em-up had become so huge, and there was just everyone was making their own versions of the beat-em-up, and, you know, two players, three players, four players, all this sort of, it was journeying towards this cooperative arcade mode, like, oh, get all your friends together and put all the coins in there, and then somehow it's like, oh, well, what if it's just each player puts in a coin, and they have to keep putting in coins, because that's all you get. So it's sort of like that I hate to be a downer, but I feel like when they realize they can make more money by pitting us against each other instead of having us work together, I feel like that's where the idea comes from. It's like, oh.
What's funny is that the competitive version of Street Fighter was a direct reaction to unhappiness on the part of players, because there was a feeling of you were being screwed by designers because they were making the games intentionally unfair. It was a little like, you know, it was a lot like the mobile game development today, where you had a hard stop. They were deliberately calculating where you should be inserting another coin. So to have a competitive multiplayer game where you could go against your friends and it became truly a matter of skill was a big deal in the arcade scene. And honestly, the arcade scene at that time was starting to flag even by the early 90s. And so Street Fighter II was that big kind of supernova burst that gave it that helped propel it forward all the way through the 90s until it kind of faded away again.
You are both correct. Absolutely. There was the cynicism there, like the realization that if people are playing a cooperative game together, the better they do, the less money a vendor is going to make, like the fewer quarters they're going to put into it. But Kat is also right, because, you know, developers realized that and said, well, we're going to force these assholes to keep giving us money. So you end up with, you know, boss fights that are just extraordinarily unfair, you know, just like super cheesy combat. I mean, Diamond, you wrote a column and a mini podcast for Retronauts a few months back about Double Dragon 3. And like, I'm just going to let you take it from here and talk about how exploitative and cruel, like just like give us your money that game was, because to me, that really kind of embodies everything that Street Fighter 2 was kind of pushing against and trying to balance out.
Well, I mean, it's funny to look back at this as a controversial, because now it's like every game does this. But yeah, when Double Dragon 3 debuted at the end, late 1990, it has microtransactions. You know, if you put a coin in to play the game, you want to get a power up, put in a coin. You want to get extra character, put in a coin. You want to unlock new moves, put in a coin. Like it literally was pay to do anything. And it was so poorly received that when the game somehow it came out in America first. And when it came to Japan, the Japanese version stripped all that out. It was so unpopular in America. The Japanese version is like, no, it's you can select any character you want. The power-ups are on the floor again. All the moves are unlocked. So they took that feature entirely out. But when it first debuted in 1990, that was how the game worked. It was how it was designed. And it was, for me as a kid, I wasn't that opposed to it, because I realized, well, if I put enough coins, I'll just get enough characters and I'll just make my way through the game. It doesn't even matter. But yeah, it's funny how once you get to Street Fighter 2 and you realize, oh, well, if I get good at this game, one coin is probably enough to beat it. But then, of course, if someone else comes along, then I have to sort of deal with them. And depending on who that person is, yeah. If it's a small child, yeah, as Jeremy talked about, like, you can toy with them.
But if it's an older toying, teen, I was trying not to be a jerk.
What I found interesting, and I was rereading the oral history of Street Fighter 2 before this podcast, and one thing I didn't realize was that when this game came out in Japan, there was a problem. The Japanese players weren't playing against each other. Mm-hmm. They were playing against the computer. They were treating it like an action game.
Right. And that's so wild to think about now, because you see all these, you know, like super competitive players, like the top ranking players. And most of them are Japanese. And they're so, so good at this game, at this series. So to just think that like that was not, you know, kind of how they started playing over there. That's wild. Sorry to interrupt. Please go ahead.
It reminded me of a story that Yu Suzuki talked about with the game Hang On, where they had this really cool motorcycle game, but nobody would go up to actually get on the motorcycle and play it. Because I think that, and I'm sorry if I'm talking out of turn, but there's maybe a little bit of a shyness or a reticence to put yourself into the spotlight. And so stepping up to a person to challenge them, I think in a game like Street Fighter 2 might be a little forward. I don't know. But the competitive scene. So as a consequence, maybe the competitive scene took off in America first with like Sunnyvale, like Golfland and Milipitas and all that.
Did they also have the same, you know, slap your quarter on the screen to guarantee your next spot in line?
That I have no idea about.
Well, the story that I heard was that shyness factor, but then once arcades sort of developed the sort of networked system where it's two, you each sit at, you know, if everyone here has been to a Japanese arcade, but for the listeners, perhaps, you don't really sit next to anybody. Well, first of all, you sit down instead of stand up. But second of all, you're not next to the person you're fighting. They have their own screen, usually across from you. So you can't even see them when you play. And that, when that apparently debuted in Japan, that's when it took off. So like once players didn't have to actually see each other, they just sat down and played and they couldn't even tell who the other person was. That's when the sort of competitive scene exploded.
I mean, that makes sense because
I don't know if that's the case.
It is genuinely intimidating to walk up to one of those machines where, you know, big, mean teenage Jeremy is standing and you're like going, oh, this guy looks really good. He's got like 5 or 6 characters deep. I don't think I can beat him. And he's going to make fun of me if I lose. Whereas in Japan, it's much more comfortable to be able to sit down. So I can understand why that's popular. But not having to see whoever you're playing with and not having to feel like you're being judged for playing poorly, it does take away a lot of the edge and makes it easier to just walk up and sit down and start playing.
So something we haven't really talked about, we've kind of touched on it, but one of the most important things about Street Fighter II is how complex it was. You could play as 8 different characters, each of whom had, you know, a number of basic moves plus special moves. You had an 8-way joystick. You had 6 action buttons. 6 action buttons. That's a long way away from Pac-Man, which was just a joystick, no buttons. And at first thought, it's like, that's so complicated. How can anyone master this? But they did a really good job of kind of mapping the game out. And I feel like it was really intuitive by giving you 2 sets. There's the punch set and the kick set. The punch set is the high set of buttons, and the kick set is the 3 lower buttons. And, you know, as you move further away from the joystick, you get more powerful. So basically, you know, those high and low attacks map onto each other. It's weirdly intuitive. And, you know, this builds on what Nishiyama created with Kung Fu and then developed further in Street Fighter, which is the idea of launching different attacks depending on your position, depending on, you know, whether you're moving forward, whether you're attacking high, whether you're crouching, whether you're jumping, but then adding that extra layer of strength. You've got a medium attack, you've got a strong attack or a fierce attack, whatever. And then on top of that, adding more variables like, are you, you know, doing a quarter circle attack when you press the punch button? Because if that's the case and you're the right character, you're going to throw a fireball, or you're going to launch yourself into the air with a super jumping punch, like a giant uppercut. It's a whole lot to master. And each character, aside from Ryu and Ken, are wildly different from each other. Like Zangief plays nothing like Chun-Li, and Chun-Li plays nothing like E-Honda, and E-Honda plays nothing like Blanca. Like, everyone is just totally different, and it really gives you, you know, we talked about this a little bit, how it gives you kind of like a way to map yourself sort of onto a character and say like, wow, I like the way this character moves, I like the way they attack, but then you have those special attacks as an additional element, and then on top of that, there's the whole combo thing, which we haven't even talked about, which is like a complete accident of design that the designers recognize, like, whoa, this thing that we did, there's this unintended effect, and it actually is really cool and makes the game really, really good. Does it unbalance the game? Maybe, but it makes it way more fun.
Have you played a fighting game without combos?
Yes, I played Street Fighter 1.
I was playing Doomsday Warrior this past week because it's coming out on the Switch next weekend, and that game does not have combos, and it does not feel good.
So correct me if I'm wrong, were cross-ups kind of an unintended thing as well, like that ended up being coded into the game once players started kind of discovering it?
Crap, what's the difference between a combo and a cross-up? I'm not smart enough.
A cross-up would be when you're jumping and you're able to hit them when their back is turned, and so circumvent a block, basically.
Oh.
I hope it's accidental, because it's really frustrating.
I feel like this game was a big boon for the video game magazines at the time.
Because, oh, it so was. Oh, my God. Because you were learning all... Because not only were you learning the actual inputs, you were learning the combos. And so, like, EGM in particular was really good about laying it all out. And, you know, it was a game that demanded so much experimentation, right? And that it was quite brilliant the way that they designed it, because you had characters who seemed kind of interesting and accessible, but as you started to master them, you naturally go, yeah, but can I learn how to play Zangief? And then you go over to an EGM and be like, oh, but what is this moves? Because holy cow, this is really complicated.
Yeah, it's weird because Street Fighter 2 seems like it should be really simple on its surface. I mean, yeah, you've got six buttons and the joystick there, but when you look at the game itself, there are only 12 characters in the game. You compare that to like Final Fight, where you have, you know, three playable characters plus, you know, as many bosses as there are Street Fighters, and then you have all the mooks who fight you in between. That's dozens of different characters. Like, this seems like it should be so much simpler. There's, you know, you're not scrolling anywhere. There aren't that many hidden items. Like, you can, you know, punch Ryu's sign or whatever. But really, like, there are no interactions with the stages for the most part. There's nowhere to go. You're just in, like, these 12 more or less static spaces against, you know, the same 12 characters. Like, how much video game depth can there possibly be to that? And yet, there's so much depth. There's so much to learn. So many different combinations. Every character, again, you know, has their own unique abilities. They have their own special moves. Even the way they attack, the way they stand, the range, like the reach of their attacks, the speed of their attacks, the height, you know, how far they can kick. Like, these things are all different for each character. And on top of that, they interact with the other characters differently. So, you know, when you have Guile fighting Zangief, it's going to be a very different experience than Guile fighting Ken, just because of the size of the characters relative to one another. Zangief is huge. He's a massive target for those, you know, sonic booms. Whereas Ryu, you know, Ken can counter the sonic booms with a Hadouken. So it's just deceptively deep. There's so much to this game. And yeah, you're right. Like, it was absolutely magazine fodder. This was a godsend for anyone working in publishing in the early 90s, because they could... I was reading EGM back then, and like, it seemed like every other issue had a Street Fighter cover. And, you know, of course, there was like, what's Street Fighter 3 going to be? Is it coming soon? Oh, no, it's not. You poor, sweet spring children. But in addition to the speculation, there was just like, wow, we found new techniques. Wow, we found new secrets. Hey, check out these amazing combos. Hey, this is a killer strategy. It's just so much to this game, so much to write about it, so much to say about it. It just went on forever.
Guides culture back in the early 90s, but that was the difference, right? I mean, you had these beat 'em ups that were one-offs. You would play them, you'd probably enjoy them, but then you'd walk away. But a game like Street Fighter was a community builder, and that meant that you would just keep coming back all the time, that the game wouldn't get tiresome. And so instead of thinking of the short term, well, how can we pump as many quarters out of a person as possible before they get tired? You had a much more long-term thing where people are like, oh, I'm going to learn this character. I'm going to learn that character. I'm going to get really good at this game. I'm going to master this game. And it laid the groundwork for competitive games to come over the course of many years. It certainly tapped something deep in my brain early in the 90s. Like, I loved Street Fighter 2. Like, I adored this game. I didn't get as many opportunities to play it as I wanted to. I did not have a Super Nintendo, so I couldn't play it there. And I couldn't easily get to arcades to play against people, so I couldn't really practice. But when I saw a Street Fighter 2 machine, I always made a beeline for it, because holy cow, like, that game just never got tired in the way that other arcade games would.
I thought that during the 80s, at least the magazines that as I was reading at the time, they didn't really cover arcade games that much. Like, you know, when arcades were shiny and new, they had like the How to Beat Pac-Man sort of books that's put out. But any of the magazines tend to focus. Yeah, I put out like console and computer strategy guides. And the arcade coverage was like really minimal. They'd have like walkthroughs of CES or, you know, pictures they stole from Famitsu or something like that. But Street Fighter 2.
Game Pro had a Hot at the Arcades section.
Yeah, but it was still pretty like small compared to console games, right? Like there's so many arcade games that just kind of like you'd see once and then never hear about again. Like it may well just not have existed. But Street Fighter 2 kind of changed that. Like there was just so much more documentation of what was going on. And then, of course, that led into Mortal Kombat. And then that just exploded even more.
Well, it's the omnipresence, right? I mean, if you write about an arcade game and no one ever sees it, then what's the point? But this game, you know, by the end of 1991, Street Fighter is everywhere. So you can absolutely cover it in your magazine because whoever's reading that magazine absolutely knows where Street Fighter 2 Machine is. They're everywhere. Five.
And there's nothing. What are you going? You could write one article about, I don't know. I mean, you could write some articles about Final Fight, but Street Fighter 2, it kind of like was the service games today. It's a game that you continued to cover because it was a game that was always evolving and was always of interest to the players. So in that respect, it was definitely of interest to the magazines at that time.
Well, to go off what Jeremy said about the sort of the controls and the sort of what seems simple but actually isn't, it's like that Othello line, right? A minute to learn, a lifetime to master. Like you can put in a coin without knowing a thing, you push the buttons, okay, I see what these buttons do, and you don't even need to use, like, for a beginner standpoint, you don't need to worry about light versus medium versus heavy. You can, as long as you figure out how to move the character back and forth, okay, this button punches, this button kicks, you can get away with just using the heavy ones, and you could probably beat some early, you know, the first couple of CPU opponents if you get lucky. But if you actually spend the time and you learn, oh, there's an advantage to using this one over this one. If I jump and press this button, my leg stays out longer. You know, it invites exploration. It invites repeat visits. But it's not so deep that when you first see the machine, you're like, oh, what do I look at the, you know, like what I feel when I look at those, no offense, Cap, when I look at those, the robot fighting games, I'm like, what am I even looking at? How many joysticks and buttons are here? Whereas this game is like, okay, I get it right away.
I think that it reminds me a little bit of speedrunning, modern speedrunning, because people would exploit the animations. As they got to really know this game, that's when we started learning how to count the frames of animation, when we started understanding that this specific moment is when you're going to clip through this character and you're going to be able to get in a hit. This move will be able to beat that move because you're going to be able to handle this frame of animation. And also when it came to the various, like I think about like the exploitations of the original Street Fighter 2, like Guile's infamous air throw and that kind of thing, where it really, on the one hand, you had the actual mechanics, which were very good, but then an entire metagame started to form around all of the crazy depth that was going on with Street Fighter 2. And that, in its own very weird way, sustained it because the most popular elements started being coded into later versions of the game. See also the combo system.
I remember seeing a cabinet somewhere in New York City that actually had a sign on it saying, like, if you lock the game as playing Guile, we don't give you your quarterback.
It's a very New York sign.
Guile was known as, like, a very powerful character at that time. I think that he was very popular in tournaments, if I recall correctly. And I found Street Fighter II tournaments fascinating at the time because, obviously, I didn't know anything about esports, but sometimes I would see little clippings in EGM. It's like, oh, there was a tournament that happened, or like the National Street Fighter II tournament happened, and this person won it, and they got all this money and a big old trophy. I was like, wow, I bet I could do well in a Street Fighter II tournament. Spoiler alert, I could not have done well in that Street Fighter II tournament.
All right, so yeah, according to a list that Jazz Rignall put together for US Gamer several years ago now, 5 years ago, wow. Street Fighter 2 and the Champion Edition are the third highest grossing and most manufactured arcade games of all time. If you combine the two together, that accounts for 200,000 cabinets that made it around the world, which is half as many as the best-selling game of all time, which was Pac-Man. But that's still a whole lot of Street Fighter II cabinets. So yes, this game was everywhere. And, you know, the thing about it is, you know, you put two people together on that same cabinet. So, you know, it wasn't just like a one person at a time experience. You had two people playing at a time. That was just money flowing constantly into arcades and into Capcom's pockets. Just an amazing phenomenon of, you know, video game culture. But, you know, we've actually gone a full hour and a half on this and haven't even gotten to the spinoffs and the alternate editions and the pop culture elements. There's so much to talk about with Street Fighter II, and we just don't have time to cover it all tonight because, well, where I'm sitting, it's very, very late at night. And I don't want to stay up until, you know, 2 a.m. talking about Street Fighter, as fun as that would be. I'm an old man now. In the 90s, back when this was new, yeah, I definitely could have done that. But I think we are going to wrap up this conversation now. But I think we all agree that we should get back together sometime soon and talk about more Street Fighter II stuff. So just to kind of cap things off, what is your personal favorite memory of Street Fighter II? Diamond, let's start with you. Putting you on the spot.
Yeah, I would say maybe a few years after the fact, once it was on home consoles, I just remember being in college and the fact that we could easily spend the entire night just playing Street Fighter II against each other, like in the dorms. And it never ended. There was no end to the entertainment. And it was just, by that point, there had been so many, you know, spinoffs, other games, other fighting games. You know, by that point, I loved fighting games. We probably don't say this enough out loud, but like, this was the fighting game that made fighting games a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just what it was. It wasn't the first one, but it was the one that made everyone realize fighting games were amazing. And just the fact that, you know, years later, this, it just holds up and it works among a group of people. I would say in recent years, thanks to High School Girl, the anime. If you haven't seen that yet, I highly recommend it. I was able to watch that here with my kids, and suddenly my kids like, so what is this game? And I was like, well, let me show you. And I happened to have the Super Nintendo Mini, and we were able to play Street Fighter II on the Super Nintendo Mini. And my son didn't really enjoy it that much, but my daughter really got excited about it. And so we were able to play Street Fighter II, you know, almost 30 years after the fact. And it holds up. It holds up perfectly. So I just feel like this game, it's going to outlive us all, and that's amazing.
Kat, what about you?
Well, I already shared my favorite memory, which was playing with my dad in a McDonald's. But I will say that with Street Fighter II, I've long since kind of bounced off the fighting game community and that kind of thing, because it's become its own little bubble. And I have like plenty of respect for what people are able to do in that. And I retain a certain amount of affection for the fighting game genre, but the FGC itself like feels a little alien to me these days. But I still have a deep place of love in my heart for Street Fighter II, because at that time, I just loved that world. I loved those games. It was forefront of my mind at all times. Like I said, I bought a tabletop RPG and everything just so that I could learn about all of the different characters and everything. I wanted to be able to learn how to do the inputs. I thought I practiced constantly until my freaking thumb got a callus trying to learn how to do the Shoryuken. And it felt so good when I was able to master those individual moves. And I think the original Street Fighter II imparted a certain language to it, so that even when I'm watching Evo to this day, even though I'm not that big into the FGC, it still kind of taps into something deep in my brain where I'm going, yes, I understand what's going on here and I'm really enjoying it. Wow, this high level play of this game that I once loved is really making me happy. But to kind of cap it off, like a recent happy memory was a couple years ago, I went into this retro arcade with Greg Ford, who actually worked at EGM back in the day. And we just came upon this Street Fighter II machine, and we're like, we got to play Street Fighter II. Come on. And so, you know, I was Ken, and he was Ryu, and he kicked my butt. But that was fine, because, I mean, it just felt so natural and so right to be standing at those controls again, playing against one another. It is truly a timeless masterpiece of a fighting game. And frankly, like, having had this conversation for the past 90 minutes or so, I want to fire up my Super NES Classic and start playing some Street Fighter II right now. I've got the itch.
You're allowed. All right, Kurt.
So, like I said before, a lot of my early Street Fighter II experience was more theoretical than something I actually did, because I was just studying magazines and being like, oh, I'm going to do these combos, and then just getting my butt kicked when I actually tried to do it. But I was super hyped about the Genesis version. Like, it was supposed to come out like in June, right as school was coming out, and then it got delayed. So that summer was just ruined. But September, that's when it actually came out, but for some reason I ended up betraying it by bought Mortal Kombat instead. So I spent most of the rest of the year playing that. But some kid in my school had gotten the Genesis version, and I borrowed it from him. And then the next week we got buried in snow, so we had the whole week off of school. So I spent all that time that I had expected to play over the summer just Street Fighter II by myself and a little bit of cajoling my brother nonstop. So that's pretty much what I think of. That one January 1994. That watching the Tech War miniseries, which was also that week.
All right. And finally, this isn't for my own memory, this isn't actually tied to the original Street Fighter II. It was with the Super NES version of Super Street Fighter II, which came a few years later. But when I was in college, I had some friends and we rented a copy of Super Street Fighter II. And there was a cheat code you could enter. There were a bunch of different features in the Super NES version that allowed you to do like tournaments and group battles and things like that. And there was one mode where you could had like a bracket tournament, and you could basically allow the CPU to control any of the characters you wanted. And there was a cheat code where you could use the same character more than once in that cheat code or in the tournaments. So for whatever reason, we decided to set all the fighters to CPU and use the cheat code and make everyone Fei Long. So it was called the Fight of the Fei Longs. And we spent an hour just watching computer controlled Fei Longs duke it out to see who won. And it's so dumb. Like, what a waste of time. But it was just, we weren't high. We weren't drunk. We were just stupid teenagers. And we were like, this is amazing. Wow. It's just like Bruce Lee fighting Bruce Lee to the death. It's so cool. Anyway, that's what I got. But we will talk about
one,
Fei Long.
Ugh. Whoa.
Yep.
God.
I think it was the one with the dark pants rather than the gray pants. But we will talk about Super Street Fighter II and many other things about, you know, the post-World Warrior Street Fighter II experience sometime down the road. I don't know exactly when, but there's so much more to say about Street Fighter II that we have not covered in this episode, and we will definitely continue this conversation before too long, sometime when we can all manage to arrange our schedules to get together and converse. Anyway, thank you, Kurt and Diamond and Kat, all of you, thank you for your time. And thanks, everyone, for listening. This is a patron-exclusive episode, so I don't need to give you the rundown on how you can listen to Retronauts and subscribe, because you already do. If you're listening to this, thank you for supporting the show. I hope you have enjoyed this patron-exclusive look back at one of the most important video games of all time, and listening to basically four people who really love the game and have a lot of experience with it just gush about it for an hour and a half. I've certainly enjoyed it. But anyway, that's the Retronauts rundown. Now it's the time for the rundown to let everyone know what's up with them and where we can find them. So let's start with you, Kat Bailey, because B comes very early in the alphabet.
Hello, I'm Kat Bailey, and you can follow me on Twitter at @the_catbot, and I have a podcast called Axe the Blood God. It's about role-playing games, and we publish every single Monday. But if you want to get it a week early and ad-free, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. I don't know when this episode's coming out, but at the moment we're doing a monthly game club with Final Fantasy VIII, and I'm developing a new appreciation for Squall Leonhardt. So you should go listen to that episode. It's available at the $10 level.
He's a good kid surrounded by a lot of idiots. Let's see. Diamond, where can we find more of your work online?
Well, if this is an exclusive episode, then everyone listening to this can already check out my weekly column, This Week in Retro. But beyond that, if you want to find me on Twitter or most other services online, you can look up Fight Club, F-E-I-T, my last name, C-L-U-B, the noun. You can also support me personally on Patreon or Ko-fi if you look up Fight Club. And yeah, I'm really enjoying all the work I've been doing so far for Retronauts and revisiting all these games. And probably by the time this episode comes out, I may very well write something about this game as well, because it is a big anniversary.
It is. And it's a big game. Yes. Kurt, how about you?
I run Hardcore Gaming 101, the retro video game website. I'm on Twitter at HG_101. We have our own site podcast, the top 47,858 games of all time, where we cover all sorts of genres. I can't remember what the last fighting game we did was. I don't think we've ever actually talked Street Fighter 2.
What? Well, you must be working your way down to the top 10.
Yeah. Once somebody nominates it, if they haven't already.
We also That's put a fun a podcast. I was on the Super Robot Wars Alpha one.
Hooray!
I'm merely a listener, but I really enjoy it.
And we put out a lot of books, although no Street Fighter ones, because Capcom has that area pretty solidified, so seems kind of redundant.
All right. And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, at Retronauts, doing Retronauts stuff. You can also find me doing Limited Run Games stuff at Limited Run Games. And of course, there is my YouTube channel. Just look for Jeremy Parrish on YouTube, and I'm covering video games chronologically. It's going to be a while before I get to Street Fighter 2. It was coming up in Super NES Works 1992, but then I got sidetracked. It's going to be like 10 years before I get back there. But, you know, that's just the dedication. That's what it takes. But fortunately, you won't have to wait another 10 years to hear more discussion of Street Fighter 2. We will be back before too long, this group or something very similar to it, to talk more about Street Fighter 2 Champion Edition and Turbo and Rainbow Edition and Super Street Fighter 2 and the cartoon and the anime and the comic books and the G.I. Joe figures. Oh my God, there's so much stuff to talk about. So please look forward to it. Thanks again for listening. And until next time, remember, I am the strongest woman in the world.